years go by, people sometimes begin to forget some things. People may forget the names of roads that they used to drive on when they lived in a different city. After the years pass, people may not remember all the names of the friends that they had 10, 20, 30, maybe 50 years ago. If people change their names, not their names, well, they could change their names, but their addresses and their phone numbers over the years, those details are also sometimes forgotten. People use computer programs that help them remember passwords because sometimes they forget logon information. When the book of Exodus opens, Exodus chapter 1, this is where we begin tonight, we read about some names. And the names mentioned in Exodus 1 are names associated with a lot of history. Many years have passed since the people described in Exodus 1 walked the earth. But as we look at the names in Exodus 1, verses 1 through 4, we find that these names have not been forgotten. If you've opened to that first chapter, let's begin reading with that first verse. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. We, as we go through life, often forget things like names and dates and places and events. But Exodus 1, verses 1 through 4, reminds us that God does not forget these things. God remembered, as we see in Exodus 1, who had descended from Jacob. He had the information down. God also remembered where these people were associated with, and that is Egypt. The last part of verse 1 tells us that God even remembered the households of these men. Then in verses 2 through 4, we have some specific names listed. Tonight, I want to think about the subject of names and God, using Exodus 1 as a launching point, but our study, the book of it, is actually going to be taken from the book of Revelation. The word names occurs in Revelation 6 times. And there are some things about this word that are, I think, significant points of application for us. We're going to begin with Revelation 3. And after we say some things about the congregation that's listed there, we're going to turn to some later sections in the book, Revelation 13, and then Revelation 17. And finally, we'll look at some information in Revelation chapter 21. In Revelation 3, we start off by reading about a congregation at a place called Sardis. Now, the congregation at Sardis received a fairly brief letter from the Lord. This letter contains only 6 verses. Even though this letter is very brief, it's really to the point. The Lord has a lot to say. And this letter really contains some harsh information. John, as he describes this congregation, as he speaks on behalf of the Lord, he says that this church possessed a reputation. As people, perhaps in that area of Asia Minor, looked at the congregation of Sardis, maybe the people in the community, it appeared that the Sardinians had a great group of people. It looked like they were a fine group of folks. It's possible, we're not told, but maybe other congregations in the area, maybe Ephesus and Laodicea, maybe Christians from other congregations looked at Sardis and thought, this is a great place. We wish that our life would allow us to live in Sardis and be part of that fine group of people. But John, as he writes to this group of people, he says, you're not nearly like your reputation. He says, you have a reputation, but I'm telling you the truth. Your reputation is deceitful. Revelation 3, verse 1. And to the angel of the church in Sardis write, these things saith he that hath the 7 spirits of God and the 7 stars. I know thy works, that thou hast a name that thou livest, and or but thou art dead. That's pretty straightforward. In verse 2, we find that there were some good things at Sardis. But John said, even these things, they're about ready to die. You're wilting, and you're about done. He said in that verse, no works at this congregation were perfected. That is, they were not completed. They were not fulfilled. This congregation had many significant issues. There were only a few people in this place who were really headed in the right direction. Notice from verse 4, the thought that we introduced from Exodus 1. Here's where we read about these names. But thou hast a few names in Sardis that did not defile their garments. And they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. Just as God knew the names of people in Exodus 1, so when we come over here to Revelation chapter 3, God says, there are some names. And God said, I know these names. Our entire earth belongs to God, and God knows who inhabits our planet. Towards the end of last week, I received a call from a man who is associated with a government agency. This man said that he was doing an investigation, and he was trying to find some people. Now, I was not initially for sure whether or not he was really from the government. I thought maybe this guy is who knows who, and maybe just, you know, trying to pry some information out of me. But as he began to tell me some of the things that he'd uncovered, I thought, well, I don't think there's any doubt at this point that he really is associated with a government agency. He'd uncovered a lot of facts, and he turned over a lot of rocks that gave him a lot of different names before he made contact with me. That call reminded me that a lot of the tools that our government has, some of the actions by our government are pretty advanced and invasive. This investigator had some names, he had some facts, but he was calling me because he lacked some information. He didn't have all the pieces to the puzzle that he's trying to solve. When it comes to God, though, he knows all the people from the past, Exodus 1. He knows all the people in the present. And he knows about all the people who will live in the future. In addition to knowing the names, God knows exactly what people are like. He's able to peer down and see exactly what an individual is like, good or bad. The few at Sardis, remember the first part of Revelation 3? They were separate from the majority. One of the TV shows on Discovery, it's been on for probably 7 or 8 years, and many of you have probably seen at least one episode of it, is Deadliest Catch. If you're not familiar with it, this is a show that is based on the Bering Sea, and the people on these boats, they go out and fish for things like king crab. If you've ever watched one of the programs, you've probably seen the deckhands. They bring up the big pots or pods, and the crab are dumped out. And those deckhands, as they process those crab, it doesn't take very long to realize that the fellows seem to be pretty adept at what they do, so they can kind of eyeball most of the crab and say, okay, the crab has to be, you know, so big. And this crab is obviously big enough. This crab is not nearly big enough, so they can instantly, with mini crab, make a firm determination and say, this is a keeper, this one is not. If you've watched some of those shows, though, you know that there are some cases where, as those men, as those deckhands, evaluate the crab, there are some cases where they say, we're not sure. This is close. This is too close to call. So we need to go ahead and we need to get out a gauge and we need to measure it to see whether or not it is of legal size so we can keep it. God's not like those crab fishermen. God is not someone who just kind of gives people a general examination and says, okay, this one is a keeper and this one is not. When it comes to God, he looks at each person individually. And he looks at each person fully. Not one thing is overlooked. I've sometimes wondered how many congregations there were, or how many people there were at the Sardinian congregation. We don't know. On an average Sunday morning, were there 50 people there? Maybe. Maybe less. Were there 100 people who came to this congregation when the saints met? Maybe more. But whatever the number of saints at this group, God says, I want you to know, there are only a few names in this group that are headed in the right direction. There is a very limited number of the people who can expect to go to heaven. Today that's still true. When we look at the religious world, even in some respects the church, there are still only a few names which please God. Jesus himself has said, Matthew 7, that at the end of time, most will be lost. There will only be a few that are saved. That gate to life is straight, it's narrow, few find it. Right now, God knows. He still knows who the few are. In the eyes of God, are we like the few at Sardis, Revelation 3? Or are we in that other category where we would be like the majority? That's an important question. We want our names to be on the list that is the very, very small list when compared to the rest of the world. All right, keeping in mind this idea of names, let's move a little more deeply into the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 13 is next. In the opening verses of Revelation 13, John describes a beast. Like many of the other images in this particular book, this idea, a beast, is not literal. John spoke of this beast rising up out of the sea, and that, of course, does not mean that one day we're going to look over to the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean, or we're going to be able to look at some great body of water on the earth, and there's going to be this strange creature that rises up from the depth. So that's not what John means at all. But like many of the other symbols in this book, there are word pictures which are designed to communicate various truths. If you've turned to the 13th chapter of Revelation, let's look at that first verse. And he stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns, 10 diadems or crowns, and upon his heads, names of blasphemy. Now, if this beast is not a literal beast that is literally coming up out of the sea, then it stands to reason the other things described in Revelation 13, verse 1 are also not literal. That is, we have a figurative picture of something. We just need to figure out what it is. If the beast is not literal, the ten horns are also not literal. The word horn, if we were to look at how the Bible uses that word, it is a way of describing power. That helps us. And the number seven describes completeness or fullness. So when we think about, you know, we have a week. Our week has 7 days. That's a full. That is a complete week. So when we think about seven horns, we're talking about some entity that has a great deal of power. The seven heads really describe the nations of the earth. The seven heads, the numbers, and the horns describe earthly powers, if you will. Revelation 13, verse 1 is a general description, a figurative description to say a lot of nations on the earth. John said that these nations had the names of blasphemy on their seven heads. Well, the names of blasphemy, once again, not literally true, but it's a way of describing unrighteousness. It's a way of saying immorality. It's a way of describing things that are contrary to God's will and word. John's point in Revelation 13, verse 1, is that civil government, as we look at the past, as we look at the present, and certainly as we look at the future, civil government, as we look at it throughout the world, will often be in opposition to the gospel. And that's right. Civil government has often been on the other side of the cross. John spoke the truth. And that's been true, as we said, in the past, in the present, and we believe it will also be true in the future. When we look at civil government, we find many examples of how pagan governments, non-Christian governments, have killed God's people for various things. We find, as we look at civil government, examples where officials have said, can't have the Bible in school. In some situations, it is illegal. They'll put you in jail for reading the Bible in a public place. Civil government has often been supportive of actions the Bible condemns. Practices such as abortion, fornication, and that includes homosexuality, gambling, drunkenness. What the Bible says is wrong. Oftentimes, civil government will come along and say, that's right. Civil government will frequently uphold what the scriptures say we need to oppose. Stated another way, civil government often calls the good things evil and good things evil things good. When it comes to the idea of names, God not only knows them all, Exodus 1, Revelation chapter 3, but he knows that there are some names, some entities, if you will, that are immoral. Revelation 13, verse 1. At the present time, when we look at our world, we find scattered throughout our earth numerous governments which are hostile to the Christian faith. Now, as these Christians receive this information, as we think about Revelation 13, verse 1 for our day and time, Christians living under a beast, under a hostile government, Christians have always had to make a choice. We either decide that we're going to side with the devil and his ways, the ways of the world, or we decide that we're going to stand up and we're going to be like the few that were among the Sardinians in Revelation chapter 3. You may remember that Jesus once said we can't have two masters. There's the way of the world. There's that beast of civil government that says, follow our ways if you want to get along. And God says, I'm the way of the minority. Choose me if you want life. All right, now with this understanding of Revelation 13, let's move on to our next passage. A few chapters over, we turn to Revelation 17. In Revelation 17, verse 3, John once again talks about a beast, civil government. But in this particular passage, he adds some information to it. He says this beast, this description for civil government, is being ridden. There is a woman on this particular beast. So it's like this terrible, this awful horse with a rider. Someone is on the back of this beast, and that, of course, would signify guidance or control. The person on the back of this beast, this description of civil government, is offering some kind of help to them. All right, Revelation 17, verse 3. There John said, and he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and seven horns. The word wilderness in this verse is an important word. John often appealed to the Old Testament as he wrote the book of Revelation, and here the word wilderness reminds us of Israel. It was in the wilderness for a while. Well, a similar thing is true with the church. If we're Christians, we're in the wilderness, not literally, but we are in the wilderness of sin. We live in a culture which is opposed to God, which is opposed to the ways of right. And as we are in that church of Christ, the church which Jesus built, we sometimes have to face the beast. There are going to be things that come from the government that are contrary to the will and the word of God. And as we face that hostility, we often find that there are only a few names, Revelation 3, who are willing to stand with us. But here in Revelation 17, John says, let's add to the picture. John says this beast has a woman sitting on this particular creature, and the color of scarlet is also introduced. Now, if you were in the adult Bible class recently, where we went through some of the things about the ancient world, you may remember that in Roman culture, politics and religion were hand in hand. Now, for us, we hear people talk about the separation of church and state, and in many places, religion and politics do not go together. That was not what first century life was like. In the first century, religion, pagan worship, drove civil government. Pagan worship, in many respects, controlled civil government. And that's precisely what we see in Revelation chapter 17, verse 3. This woman that is on the beast, she represents false religion. False religion directed civil government, controlled a lot of things in that ancient time. Now, it would have been bad enough in John's day, and certainly even in our day, if you have a government which is hostile towards your faith. How are you going to stand against that? But when that hostile government has this additional force, false religion, also coming against a child of God, that's going to really, really challenge our faith. Some will not give in to the immorality endorsed by a false government, Revelation 13, verse 1. But when it comes to false religion, Revelation 17, verse 3, people will say, well, that's different. And we're okay with that, whether it's a variation of the Christianity that we describe, that we find described in the Bible, or whether it is a false religion, which is radical in the sense that it does not even recognize Jesus as the Son of God, some people will head off in these alternative ways. But from what we've noted earlier, God has, figuratively speaking, a list of names. He knows who everyone is, and he's watching the choices that we make as we go through life. We can, therefore, choose to be like those few names at Sardis who were trying to do what was right. They were trying to be faithful. Or we can be like the rest of the group at Sardis and not be faithful. This is a very, very important choice. In fact, it is the most important choice that we will ever make in life. Revelation 17:3, if you look carefully at the verse, also uses the word full. And that's an important word. When we think about the beast, civil government. When we think about false religion, we find that these two entities are often full of things contrary to the way of God, to the way of the truth. And the word full reminds us that we do not have to partake of everything that Satan and the false religions of our world offer. It's almost like the devil has a smorgasbord and he says, here are 1,000 items that you can choose from. We don't have to pick from every item on the table to go ahead and be separated from God. One or two will be enough to destroy us spiritually. When it comes to the idea of names, we want our name to be in the right place. The book of Revelation tells us that that's possible. We find this information in that last reference that I gave earlier, Revelation chapter 21. Turning now there, we want to look at two verses, Revelation 21, verse 14. And also after we deal with that, Revelation 21, verse 12. We start with Revelation 21, 14, because this passage has, I think, the least application for us. Here John talks about the apostles. He says, and the wall of the city had 12 foundations. And on them, the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, it's a nice thing. The apostles were great men. Not perfect men, but they were wonderful men. They did some great things. So it's nice. It's wonderful that God has their names in a special place. But there's not a single person here who's an apostle. Nobody else on the earth right now is an apostle. They're all gone. So are the apostles the only ones that can have their names in a special place? Well, let's see. Revelation 21, backing up two verses to the information in verse 12. Having a wall, great and high, having 12 gates, and at the 12 gates, 12 angels, and names written thereon. And he says, these names are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. This expression, the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, in the book of Revelation is simply another way of describing the church, or we might say Christians. This verse tells us, this verse reassures us, that the names of the saved, those few names that we've talked about earlier, they are precious in God's sight. And John, as he comes to the close of this book, he says, I want you to know, these few names, these precious names, the names of the saved are written. As we go through life, I think it's probably pretty fair to say that there's not a single person here who will one day have their name written on a White House guest list. Our name may never appear as far as an important record or maybe some kind of achievement in a workplace. And it's probably also fair to say that there's not a single person here who will one day have their name recorded in some kind of great history book. But John says, I want you to know, if you will be a faithful Christian, your name can be written somewhere. It will be written in the most important place of all. That is, in the mind of God. What a comforting thought as we seek to live for Christ. Our name can be one of the few that's written by and for God. Is our name on that list? Is our name on the list of the few? If it is, let's rejoice. Let's rejoice and take great comfort in that fact every single day. But if our name is not on that list, and it's a short list compared to the many at least, if our name's not on that list, we have at least one more chance to make sure it's there. It is added to that list, if you will, by becoming a Christian. Faith, repentance, confession, baptism, and it stays on that list as we continue to walk in the light, as we live the Christian life. Is our name written there in the mind of God? That's what we want to think about. And if, as we sing the invitation song in just a moment, if we know our name is not there tonight, make that right, will you not, as we stand and encourage you with the selected song.
There's a fountain free kiss for you and me. Let us haste, oh haste, to its spring. 'Tis a fount of love from the source above, and he bids us all freely drink. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me, thirsty soul. Hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all. There's a living stream with a crystal gleam from the throne of life. Now it flows. While the waters roll, let the weary soul hear the call that forth freely goes. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? Is for you and me, thirsty soul. Hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all. There's a rock that's cleft, and no soul is left that may not its pure water share. 'Tis for you and me, and its stream I see. Let us hasten joyfully there. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me, thirsty soul. Hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all.
Be seated, please. If there are any here this evening who are not able to partake of the Lord's Supper this morning, if you come to the front pew at this time, you'll be served. Any announcements I need to make before we're dismissed that I didn't make earlier?
Silver Hawks game, if you're interested, Lois got the sign-up sheet tonight to last night, so remember Scott. Glenn, and how's Glenn doing, Steve? Okay, that's good. Did they find anything? Distress? Yeah, that's, I'm sure, I mean, having a sick son as long as the he's been. I mean, we need to, you know, keep the sailors in our prayers. That's got to be tough for everybody. So, it goes obviously. Yeah, well, that's true. anything else in, this evening? If not, we'll sing all, stand and sing all three verses of 256.
I'm not ashamed to own my Lord, nor to defend his cause. Maintain the honor of his word, the glory of his cross. Firm as his throne, his promise stands, and he can well.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.